On Saturday, October 26th, we intend to let the government know, the White House, the Congress, and all the powers that be, that a new anti-war movement is coming into being.
I think that the crisis of the 60s was misunderstood at the time as a generational crisis, a youth revolt, and so on, but it really had to do with the failure of the elders.
This resolution is a largely symbolic thing, of course, but it's really important coming out of Bush's hometown. Hopefully it will be somewhat embarrassing on some level for the Bush administration.
People are coming out and bringing their children, they're bringing their grandparents, they're bringing their parents. It'll be huge in number and militant in vision.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Tomorrow, hundreds of buses will converge on Washington, D.C. from across the country for what organizers expect will be the largest anti-war demonstration since the Vietnam era. Reem Kathuta from WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C. has the story.
George Bush, you do not have the right to send thousands of young Americans to kill and be killed in a war that's not only illegal but immoral, and a war that's based on fabrication and deceit. And on Saturday, October 26th, we intend to let the government know, the White House, the Congress, and all the powers that be, that a new anti-war movement is coming into being.
Answer: Act Now to Stop War and End Racism called a national march and rally to stop the war before it starts for Saturday, October 26th. They held a press conference on the beautiful Constitution Gardens, the East Coast rally site at 21st and Constitution in Washington, D.C.
Mara Verhaden Hilliard, the co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice, an attorney who's been fighting for free speech rights for demonstrators and is also a member of the ANSWER National Steering Committee.
We are planning a massive, massive demonstration of people. It is a permitted demonstration. People are coming out and bringing their children, they're bringing their grandparents, they're bringing their parents. It'll be huge in number and militant in vision.
Mahdi Bray, the executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation.
I was present at the Rayburn Building last Thursday, spoke with a national panel of religious leaders, including Bob Eckert from the National Council of Churches, 11 Methodist bishops, people from the Episcopalian Church, the American Friends Association, the Muslim community, Rabbi Lerner, and none of them are supporting this and came to Washington, D.C. to say very emphatically that they were opposed to this. The religious community is out in front. Unlike the Vietnam War, we're not waiting 3 years. We're out in front now. Mainstream religious community saying, no, we do not want this war, know that this war is immoral, and know that this war is not something that's going to benefit the people of Iraq. It's not about the left or the right. It's not about jackasses and elephants. It's about dignity. It's about preserving life. So therefore, we're not going to beat the drums of war, but rather on October 26th, in a massive way, we're going to stand forth and be drum majors for peace.
Attorney Mara Verheyden Hillard, co-founder of Partnership for Civil Liberties, reminded the press of the illegality of any war against Iraq.
With regard to the Security Council, it is the same issue with the Congress of the United States. This is an illegal, preemptive war. It violates the UN Charter. And Congress cannot legalize an illegal war, and the UN Security Council cannot legalize an illegal war. They can put pen to paper, but all they can do is ratify an illegal act. They cannot make it any more legal. And we oppose an attack, a violent attack, a preemptive war, a war of aggression against the people of Iraq.
Brian Becker of ANSWER Steering Committee preempted the Bush's administration's argument for going into Iraq.
I don't think there are any political supporters of Saddam Hussein in the United States. I don't know. We haven't found any. We don't think it's an issue. We think that the United States, as it seeks to carry out regime change in Iraq, though, violates a fundamental principle. The principle is the right of self-determination. Who gets to determine the leadership and the governments of countries around the world? Are they foreign powers using the force of arms to come in and carry out regime change? The United States did this covertly in Chile. and overthrew a democratically elected government of Allende. Didn't matter whether Allende was a Democrat or a dictator, the CIA executed Patrice Lumumba, and the people of the Congo got Mobutu. The United States CIA overthrew the Shah, overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, when he nationalized British Petroleum's oil reserves. And we got the Shah of Iran, or I should say the Iranian people got the Shah of Iran. In 1954 in Guatemala, when a democratically elected government, Arbenz, nationalized the United Fruit Plantations, the CIA overthrew Arbenz and put into power a military death squad government, and we got, or I should say the Guatemalan people got, a death squad government that killed more than 100,000 or 200,000 mainly Mayan Indians. We are not supporters of the Iraqi government. We do not take a stand about the Iraqi people's right to overthrow that government, but we do believe that the United States government has no right, using the force of its military machine, to go in and dictate and determine the leadership of any country. And we know from history that the results of this kind of regime change are predictably catastrophic and not helpful for the people of the country.
Various labor organizations are against this war, and many have officially endorsed the march on the White House to oppose it.
The New York City Labor Against the War, NYCLA, has endorsed the demonstration. They're very much a part of the movement, as they have been for the past year. We also have the support and endorsement of 1199 Health and Hospital Workers Union, the Rochester, New York, AFL-CIO Central Labor Council, District Council 1707, AFSCME in New York City, and the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union, ILWU, the Embattled Workers. The drill team from the union will be here and symbolically helping us to lead the march, because those dock workers are directly and negatively affected by the so-called war on terrorism, because the Bush administration has falsely used this issue to intervene in their labor dispute to support the maritime bosses in invoking Taft-Hartley on the basis that ships had to be able to access West Coast ports to carry out its planned war against Iraq. So those workers are directly, materially, negatively affected, and they're joining us, not simply because it hurts them as a union, but because they have a long legacy of activity in the anti-war movement. Under Harry Bridges, the ILWU became a major factor in the anti-war protests during the Vietnam War as well.
The demonstration will start at 11 a.m. by a rally in the Constitution Gardens, where many veteran anti-war and new voices will address the build-up against Iraq. At 1:30 p.m., the protesters will march the short distance to the White House to voice their opposition to this war. At 3:30 p.m., after marching around the White House, the protesters will come back to Constitution Gardens for a closing rally. The rally site is adjacent to the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial to remind all of the human lives toll of the last USA's interventionist war. The Washington, D.C. contingent of the demonstration will meet at 21st and Constitution in front of Albert Einstein statue at 10:30 a.m. and march to the rally.
Tomorrow, Arab American grandfathers, grandmothers, children, fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers will take to the street. They will take to the street to make yet another glorious day. Tomorrow, our community, the Arab American community, will join all communities across the gender divide, the religious divide, the national divide, across the language barriers. They will join across the nation to make a glorious day. Glory is made by those who stand for what is just when it is difficult to stand for what is just. Tomorrow, Arab Americans will stand for what is just along with all for four reasons. One, because we do not want to kill our children in Iraq. Two, because we do not want to kill our children in Palestine. Three, because we don't want to be seen and perceived as conspirators and fifth columnists against our communities here in the United States. For we are part and parcel of this community, and we are proud to be part of what is best about in this community, making a just world. And four, we are there tomorrow to build a community for our children here, for our children in the United States, across all divides. Don't kill the Iraqi children. Don't kill the Palestinian children. Don't present our children as conspirators and let us build schools for our children in the United States.
Ilyas Rashmawi from Free Palestine Alliance, speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Rimkat Khuda, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., with David Russo from the Independent Media Center in D.C.
In addition to major anti-war rallies in Washington and San Francisco this weekend, protests are due to take place around the country. In Nashville, Tennessee, activists will hold an anti-war, anti-weapons march. In Taos, New Mexico, marchers will gather outside the home of War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. And in Texas, a peace march is scheduled in San Antonio. In Austin, Texas, Bush's hometown, students at the University of Texas delivered the president what they're hoping will be an embarrassment to him politically. Forrest Wilder is a senior at UT Austin, and he describes a recent campus debate around an anti-war resolution.
I'm going to guess there was about 150 people there that were not student government members that were there to debate, and there's about 40 people in the assembly. And as people supporting the resolution, there are quite a bit more. There's probably about, I'd say, 100, 120. On the other side, there was about 30. And there's two mics that are set up on one side. On the left side, interestingly enough, it was the anti-war people. And on the right side were groups like the Young Conservatives of Texas and the College Republicans and groups like that. And the floor was thrown open to debate, and each side went back and forth making their case. There was a lot of catcalling and people, you know, getting very excited and intensely debating this issue. And I don't think that the student government seen anything like that in a long time.
What do you suppose actually got the students on campus so energized or mobilized around this particular issue?
Well, first of all, UT Austin is the biggest university in the country now. There's 52,000 people, undergraduates and graduates, that go to our school. And so, I mean, naturally there's going to be a wide range of opinion. And like most college campuses, it's relatively apathetic. There's a small pool of people who are sort of active in campus politics or politics on a larger scale. And beyond that, there's usually not much activity, but on this issue, it's really galvanized both sides. I think we're seeing something of a polarization on both sides, but then also as a nascent anti-war movement that I think excites a lot of people. And then on the other side, the conservative side, it also mobilizes those people. And this issue is just particularly important right now, and I think people are finally realizing that. So
it's interesting because we know that there was a lot of student activism around the Vietnam War back in the 60s. Much of what was compelling that debate, however, was the fact that there was a draft in place.
Right.
That's not the case today. However, you're saying that there seems to be an energy around this that is unprecedented.
Yeah, I think it is unprecedented. I mean, I think people have gotten to the point where they don't need to be, there doesn't need to be a draft for people's conscience to be sort of, to be pricked, for people to become aware. I'm sort of optimistic that I think in this country we've gotten to the point where people are willing to stand up for other individuals and are just generally more cognizant of the way global politics work. And I think it's important and a good thing.
I understand there was also some debate, and a rather bitter debate, around whether this organization, this assembly, should be voting on a resolution at all.
Yeah, well, I think that was a tactic to table it.
Much like the Congress, huh?
Right. I mean, people were saying this isn't germane to student government. It's out of our scope. It doesn't have anything to do with us. And the arguments against that point of view were, I think, were very good and were devastating to that point of view. I mean, people were saying, look, I mean, this involves war on terrorism. This involves our servicemen possibly being killed over there. It involves, it's an international affair, but it's also a local affair, because It's the same argument that our government makes, that, you know, the war on terrorism will affect you, pointing the finger at every citizen of the United States. So, you know, of course that this pertains to us here, yes, even in Austin, Texas.
Do you all have recruiters on your campus?
CIA recruiters?
Well, no, I hadn't thought of that. I was actually talking about recruiters for the military.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a large ROTC.
You can answer the first question, too, though.
Yeah, we do have CIA recruiters. It's been documented. Huh. They're actually pretty open about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a large ROTC program. There's lots of military research that goes on at UT. It's a very militarized campus. It always has been.
What other actions does the anti-war movement plan, if any, to try and prevent this or to move this this position forward?
Well, there's several groups on campus that are really active and do a lot of great work. One of them that I'm involved with is the Campus Coalition for Peace and Justice. In fact, today we have a what's called a speak out, and it's there's a space on campus that's a free speech zone, they call it. And we're going to have a sound system, and it's just going to be an open mic for people to come up and speak out or for, if they choose to do so, on the war. That's an example of one thing. There's been lots of teach-ins. There's a tomorrow is an international day action against the war in Iraq, and there's a large march and rally planned for Austin. This resolution is a largely symbolic thing, of course, but it's really important coming out of Bush's hometown. Hopefully it will be somewhat embarrassing on some level for the Bush administration.
That was Forrest Wilder. A name synonymous with the student activist movement of the 60s is Tom Hayden. He was head of the Students for Democratic Society in the 60s and famous for his role in the Chicago 7 trial, where Hayden and six others were arrested and charged with starting a riot at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We spoke with Hayden about today's generation of student activism.
I think that the comparisons are often misleading with the 60s. You know, today's level of activism is quite frequently compared with the end of the 60s, where there were hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million in the streets. But if you make the comparison with the war that's coming in Iraq versus a similar point, it would be 1965, when Lyndon Johnson had been elected on an anti-war pledge and then went to war, and the first anti-war march in Washington was the spring of 65. And I remember standing there on the stage looking at this throng of people. I was very, very moved, but it was about 20 or 25,000 people. So comparatively, there have been bigger demonstrations in New York and in the Bay Area already.
And there's one scheduled for Washington, D.C. tomorrow, and actually another one in San Francisco tomorrow as well.
Well, I'm sure they'll be comparable or larger than the early anti-Vietnam marches.
But now, as a professor at Occidental College, have you had an opportunity to actually talk with the students, or are you seeing activity on the campus that sort of heartens you to feel as though this generation is not necessarily the so-called Generation X that's just basically concerned about, you know, its own affairs?
I think this generation has had to struggle to fight off a profound mislabeling. Profound. Some of it is the laziness of the media. Some of it is the neoconservative critics trying to spread confusion. So I think it's a very misunderstood generation.
There is, however, a very distinct difference between the lives of the students in the 60s and those in the year 2002. That difference is the draft. Students in the 60s had to get politically educated quick because the possibility of being drafted was sort of looming overhead.
I think the students today are all the more impressive because they're not facing the draft.
How much of a factor was it in the 60s when you and the others were deciding to take the type of stance that you took?
I think it was real but secondary. And again, those who want to downplay the historic magnitude of the 60s will always say we did it because we're afraid of the draft. That leads to an insidious argument today that the anti-war movement was afraid of the challenge of going to war, and it's totally absurd. The demonstrators in the 60s risked their lives in Mississippi. They risked their lives over and over again. They went to jail. Their careers were damaged and so on.
And if you had an opportunity to speak directly to some of the activists, are there lessons that were learned in the 60s that they might benefit from today?
I don't think lessons are easily learned over a space of 40 years, and that's what we're really talking about here. But certainly, there's no point in preaching to young people. I think that the crisis of the 60s was misunderstood at the time as a generational crisis, a youth revolt, and so on. But it really had to do with the failure of the elders. My father would not speak to me for 20 years because of my activities. He echoed and believed in J. Edgar Hoover, the John Ashcroft of his time, the FBI director, who thought that student rebels were some kind of sinister anti-American conspiracy. The Democratic and Republican parties both ushered in the Vietnam War and all of the slaughter that followed, tragic. So today, unfortunately, if there's a parallel, it's the failure of the elders. You've got too few Democrats standing up. It's no excuse to say that we're confused or, you know, Saddam Hussein is a bad guy. Same thing's been said in the past. The elders of today would be best counseled to remember their roots in anti-authoritarianism in the 60s, I think.
And the climate that seems to be so pervasive today is one of a very rigorous, flag-waving, let's sort of fall in line behind the president or be deemed anti-patriotic or unpatriotic.
Right. Well, they're trying to impose that climate. I don't know how far it goes. That is a difference with the 60s. The big difference, of course, is that American citizens, innocent American citizens, were killed by the thousands in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, and no such provocation started the Vietnam War. On the contrary, so you do have a different situation, but it's all the more impressive that young people and students and some veterans of the past movements are demonstrating to show that they're not afraid, that they're coming out of this isolation that Ashcroft and the administration wants to place them in. They are having an impact on the public dialogue. They are helping force the Bush administration seek greater UN support and the rest of it. And you know, it all depends on whether the war, when and if it begins, and I think it probably will, becomes a quagmire. And if it does become a quagmire, as many believe, then I think the anti-war forces here and around the world will really grow like something we haven't seen in a long time. If, on the other hand, it's a short, bloody war ending in a U.S. military protectorate over Iraq and the oil supplies, and it spreads to Iran and Syria and so on, I think you'll see perhaps a decline in demonstrations, but a growth in criticism of the evolution of a new American empire, which many of these people like Wolfowitz and Pearl and the administration's neoconservative hawks are preaching. So there are some similarities, I think, in the situation that we're in, but I'm pretty keen on the idealism and the sophistication of this new generation of activism.
I just spoke earlier today with a student from the University of Texas, which is the largest university in the country, and it's also in President Bush's hometown. And he talked about the fact that that student government there just passed a resolution instructing President Bush not to launch an attack against Saddam Hussein. But he also mentioned that the campus, there are visible recruiters, CIA recruiters on that campus.
That's right.
As well as recruiters for the military.
Yes, I was down in Austin not so long ago. That's true. There's also a lot of silence and so on. But the instructive thing, as Jack Newfield, the Village Voice writer long ago called the New Left, is there really definitely is a prophetic minority in this country on the campuses. And they're going to give this administration a hard time, and I predict that they are a wave of the future and a leadership that this country will come to cherish and respect.
Noted longtime activist Tom Hayden. Flags are flying at half-staff in Minnesota this evening. U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, his wife and daughter were killed in a plane crash today near the Eveleth, Virginia Municipal Airport. Three of his staff members and two crew members also died. A recorded media message from the FAA says a plane en route from the Twin Cities crashed in a heavily wooded area in Los Angeles in August 2002. On a panel discussion about the state of democracy in America, Wellstone describes what politics means to him. We have an excerpt of that discussion.
Politics is not just local, it's personal. And I find in conversations with people everywhere in Minnesota and around the country, the focus is on how can I earn a decent living so I can support my family and give my children the care they need and deserve. Health security, people are so worried about there not being health security for families, a good education for their children. And I think that part of the sterility of the politics right now, and it's up to us to change this, is to be told that with record economic performance, record low unemployment, we can't even now, Rabbi, afford to provide good education for every child, health security for every citizen, affordable child care, that we should tolerate a social arrangements that allow children to be the most poverty-stricken group in the country. We can do a lot better than that with record surpluses, and that's where we want to see the Democratic Party go. And I think the challenge is to basically speak to these issues and to speak to people and include people. And it's a challenge not yet met. These are the winning issues, these bread and butter economic issues, these family workaday majority issues. To me, George W. wants to repeal the 20th century. And Congressman, I see these folks in the House and the Senate, and you do as well. I don't want them controlling the federal government. I don't want them to turn the clock back. I don't want to see that happen. How can it be that we have all these very, some of the best grassroots organizing I've seen, anti-sweatshop organizing on campuses, living wage campaigns, organizing the unorganized SEIU right here in L.A., clean money, clean election, and yet the whole doesn't equal the sum of the parts. You don't see that reflected nationally or in the nation's capital. And what can we do? I think that the politics we build has got to have three critical ingredients. A, ideas program, otherwise you got a movement without a direction. And frankly, people are not just interested in denunciation, they're interested in enunciation, what you're for. B, a grassroots constituency to fight for. Just putting it forward doesn't in and of itself do the job. And C, electoral politics. And I think we got to build a vehicle after this election where we put together that kind of politics, because if George W. wins, it's an all-out battle.
U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, dead at age 58. Special thanks to Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres of the Pacifica Archives for that tape. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, a closer look at the legacy of Senator Wellstone.